This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searls. This week, Sean Powers joins me in interviewing Dan Lynch. Dan Lynch is another one of our co-hosts, has an extremely interesting life in Liverpool, where he runs the local lug there. He's been involved in open source activities all over the place. Has lots of wisdom about the music business. He's a musician, and about how to organize community stuff. All kinds of interesting history for him and the whole open source industry and all that kind of stuff. It's really good, and that is coming up next.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 737, recorded Wednesday, June 21st, 2023. Live, lug, and rock on. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures that if a device isn't secure, it can't access your apps. It's zero trust for Okta. Visit collide.com/floss and book a demo today. And by Bitwarden, get the password manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that drastically increases your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Hello again, everybody everywhere. I am Doc Searls. This is Floss Weekly, and this week I am joined by two co-hosts, one of which is actually the guest. It's going to be Dan Lynch. Dan is in Liverpool. He has huge experience with Linux community building, with music, much other stuff. There he is on screen now. Hi, Dan.
I wasn't sure if I was supposed to talk or not.
And I was going to introduce Sean, too. So this is the first time. This is a new idea that I had there, Sean.
And Sean has a blue shirt. That's Sean's resume.
We have so many so many guests. You know, we have basically 52 different ones a year, or 51 is we have 1 week off. And I think I've been at this 3 or 4 years now. So hundreds of guests, and some of the most interesting people we could have are our own co-hosts, who are notable people on their own. And Dan is the first in line for that. So before I bring Dan on, Sean, what do you know about Dan so far?
No pressure.
I know that he has a similar difficulty with Celsius and Fahrenheit that I do, because he had to look it up to describe how hot it was earlier. And it's like upper 80s. So, I mean, it's really hot.
It's upper 80s.
To be clear, I mean, he's not, you know, his house isn't melting to the boiling point.
So do you have... So Dan, do you have air conditioning there in Liverpool?
No, we don't have it, because it doesn't get that hot. It doesn't get this hot very often. So in the UK, I mean, it's strange, because I'm in Liverpool in the UK, which is northwest of the UK, and we're right on the sea, on the coast, which is usually quite mild, which is nice. But the UK is kind of uniquely positioned as a country, because when it gets too cold, we can't handle it, and when it gets too hot, we can't handle it. So it seems to be either one or the other. We don't seem to be in the middle very often. It's either like it's snowing and we can't handle snow, like all the trains stop and everything else. And in the last week, we've had a heat wave. Last 2 weeks, we've had a heat wave here. So we've been up to nearly 35 Celsius, which is...
That's in the 90s.
It's about 90. Yeah, it's about 90 odd.
So we have a similar situation in Santa Barbara, which is where I technically live. And I've been there for the last 2 months. So you've seen me there if you've seen me or heard me. And... we have no air conditioning in our house there. And this is at the 34th parallel. This is pretty far south. But it's also on the ocean. There's a constant ocean breeze. And so the myth is that it doesn't get hot there, but it actually does. And you can open all the windows and doors. We have big slider doors that are, I just hit my mic. Sorry. Big side, cause I talk with my hands. You can't hear them, but I talk with them anyway. So we have big sliding doors, so you can get a lot of air through the house. But even there, that doesn't always work. So we have four box fans in a closet that people could take out and use. And but I've noticed, like in Germany, when I've been there, it's like you're not allowed to use air conditioning before a certain time. And they have this belief, or some of them do, that that air conditioning is bad for you, which I don't think is true. I'm in an air conditioned building right now. I don't think it's bad for me. So anyway,
we had an air conditioner filled with black mold. I don't think that was good for us.
No, that was
that. No, that's not good.
So I'm not going to explain Dan too much. So Dan, let's just start with how you got into open source and Linux, and
there in Liverpool. Certainly, yeah. So let's see. I'll take it way back. So I originally was a sound engineer, which you can tell by all these people watching the video. I have lots of like impressive looking microphone stands and mixers and audio equipment around and stuff around my little studio here. So I used to work with bands, actually doing audio stuff, did some tours and so on. Not anyone you would have heard of, I don't think. Some friends of mine did the Fun Loving Criminals, who you probably know, and things like that, but I don't think I made it onto that tour. But anyway, so I did that for quite a while, and then work in that kind of dried up, and I was still pretty young, so I decided to go to university to do, or college as you guys call it over there, to do computer science. So I did a computer science degree around 2000, started around 2000, somewhere around there. And that was where I kind of became exposed to lots of things. Although, strangely, we didn't do a lot. We didn't actually do Linux as part of our course. We didn't even do Unix. We didn't do any kind of Unix. It was all Microsoft-based stuff, pretty much.
So nothing in the command line, nothing with
not really.
Huh.
Yeah, it was strange. Yeah, it was. I mean, I hope it's changed now. I'm going back 23 years now. So I hope it's changed by now. But a lot of our stuff was based around the course that I was on was based around those kind of Microsoft certs that they do for developers and engineers and all the rest of it. I don't know if they had some, maybe there was some kind of link between the university and Microsoft. I believe the year after I left, because I did networking as well, because I got really into networking stuff, and we didn't have a lot of hardware stuff. So a lot of the networking was theoretical, which is, it's interesting, but it's not the best way, in my opinion, to learn how to do networking. You really need to get things and start plugging them into each other and go, oh, that doesn't work, or this doesn't work. So I remember distinctly spending a long time learning how to make IP addresses from binary, how to translate IP addresses from binary code and all this kind of stuff, which I've never used in my life since then. they said, oh, you'll need to know this. You'll need to know this. And I've never used that in my life since then because I just didn't need to. But it was interesting. But my actual introduction to Linux came from a fellow student who was doing... He decided, I think it might have been for part of his final project, but he was doing something about Linux, and he showed me Mandrake at the time. Don't know which version. I think it might have been 7 Mandrake 7, maybe 8, I'm not sure. But anyway, he showed me that, and part of his kind of project that he was doing was asking people whether they could complete certain tasks with, say, OpenOffice at the time was the big thing. Now LibreOffice, and there's the split there, but OpenOffice, he'd basically say to us, here's a computer, I want you to write a letter, I want you to make a spreadsheet, I want you to do this, and we had to figure it out, and it was really easy. And I thought, wow, this is as good if not better than the stuff I'm doing on Windows. So then I got the first version of Linux I ever used at home was SUSE, or SUSE. I don't know how to say that.
Nobody does.
I think it's SUSE, isn't it? Because it's German. It's German. It's German. So yeah. Yeah, so this was before they made OpenSUSE and all that. Before, I think Novell might have owned them at the time. But anyway, it came on a magazine. That was where my first introduction to Linux came. It came on the front of a magazine. I can't remember what magazine it was. I apologize, Doc. I don't know if it's one of yours.
it was. It was Linux been. Journal. I just insist that was true.
I mean, even though we never shipped discs, it was definitely us.
We would sometimes
have a special
disc
edition
attached,
that you did.
Yeah, it could be. I don't remember, but yeah.
Yeah, so I just picked that up in a shop, and it had a CD on the front which said, you can install, I think it was SUSE 7.something. And I thought, well, this can't be very good because they're giving it away. I mean, how useful can it realistically be? So I went home and I put it in my computer and I booted up from the CD. And the first thing I noticed was at the time when you installed, it would have been, when was XP around then? Maybe Windows XP or something around that time. The installer was awful on Windows, and it looked really bad, and it wasn't easy to use, and it just looked really old. It looked like an old, you know, text-based installer. And I put this in, and it had like beautiful graphics, and it was doing all this like even like animation and stuff while I was installing it. And I was like, this is ridiculous. So then I got into using it. Yeah. I ended up, I had been a .NET developer. That's the dirty secret that some people do know about me and others don't, was I actually worked as a .NET developer, a Microsoft .NET developer, long before they did the Mono project and all that sort of stuff, and a lot of the open source stuff came out. I worked for the NHS in the UK, which is the health service, developing tools for the clinicians to use in .NET. A lot of them ASP.NET, kind of web-based stuff, for recording medical tests and results and stuff and trials. We did a really interesting one, actually, yeah. For... I don't know if we want to get into medical stuff particularly on this, but it was to do with a new procedure they were trying at the time in the hospital where I worked for people with osteoporosis. So anybody who had like spinal problems, they were trying something where they would inject surgical cement into the spine at certain points, and then they would have to record how effective that was for each different kind of vertebrate. So I had to build a system. I had to write a system where you could record, you know, which vertebrae it was, how much stuff you'd injected, all that kind of stuff. And then they used all that to analyze the results.
Did they find that Windows caused osteoporosis at all?
Sorry. I think some of the chairs might have done in that place. Some of the office chairs that we had may well have done. But yeah, while I was doing that, I was kind of on the side getting really into PHP and stuff like that. Which led to, and then Apache. I actually convinced my boss to let me install Fedora on a couple of the machines in the office, and I got them into playing with that. Some of the guys had seen Red Hat before. So yeah, I kind of got into doing that. And then from there, I ended up pushing more and more into Linux, got into Python, got very, very into Python, actually, and into Drupal as well. I did a bit of Drupal stuff,
You were fully on Linux at this point, and were you running on Fedora or still on SUSE?
Yeah. I think I was probably using SUSE, but I used to. So back then I'm laughing to myself now because I can't believe I did it, but I used to every week completely wipe my computer and install a new distribution. This was my main kind of computer that I used every day. Because I thought the only way to really learn and to really test something is to throw yourself in at the deep end. So sorry, Sean, you were saying.
No, I was just saying I reinstall systems far too often. And for me, unfortunately, sometimes it's easier to start over than to try to figure out what you did to mess up the last install.
Yeah, it can be. But I used to do that. And then I started writing about I started writing reviews of the distributions. On each week, I'd do a new distribution. So I went through all kinds of all the popular ones to lots of obscure ones. I think Arch Linux was one of the hardest installs I ever did at the time. This was a long time ago now. I believe it's a lot easier now. And then fortunately, I managed to get into things like, there was a Linux Planet was a kind of a news site, and I started. They actually contacted me and asked me to write for them, doing things like that. So I ended up nowhere near you the journalistic chops that you guys have got. But I kind of did a little bit of that, reviewing Linux distros for them and various other things, which was really interesting.
So I'm curious, what are you using right now? I mean, what are we talking to you through?
So I'm using Linux Mint at the moment. Because I've got lazy, or I don't know. Maybe it's just I haven't got as much time as I used to have. But I haven't reinstalled this in maybe 2 years. The laptop that I'm using right now, I haven't reinstalled in 2 years. I ended up getting involved with doing stuff with Ubuntu, as many people did when that became kind of popular, late 2000s, and then moved on to Linux Mint, did some stuff with Debian as well. So Mint's an interesting one because you can get it. It was originally based on Ubuntu, like a lot of things are, and then it moved to being based on Debian. So that was quite interesting because people kind of decided they wanted a more vanilla kind of Debian experience. So it's quite nice. Yeah.
Is it all on Debian? Because there was a while where you had both. There was like...
I think there's a choice. I think you can choose.
Is there still a choice? I know there was a choice, the Ubuntu or the Debian-based one. Debian being just a rolling distro that like you didn't have to worry about versioning. It just like kept going forever, which is kind of the Debian way.
Yeah, I think it is, to be honest. I'm just looking. I'm doing some live research here because I can't remember. I'm just on the Linux Mint website having a look. Yeah, they've got various different versions, but I don't know whether they've fully moved to be. It doesn't tell you what it's based on now out of the box. You did used to be able to choose. That's right.
Yeah. I remember because I was like Debian or the traditional one that they had. I think now maybe there's different window or the different desktop managers you can choose like that it there's installs by default, like Cinnamon and all that stuff.
Yeah, you can use, so Cinnamon's the default one, Node 3 with Cinnamon. You can use LMDA, you can use XFCE, I think, some of the lighter weight kind of ones. And there's a KDE version, I'm sure there's a KDE version as well. I haven't actually used KDE in a long time, though, so I don't know what that's up to at the moment. But yeah, so, I mean, I got really into that, and then I got into podcasting was the big thing, because I'd done... tech. Obviously, I'd done computing. I'd been working in computing. I was still working in computing, but I'd started out doing audio. So I still loved doing audio stuff. And in kind of mid 2000s, it would have been 2007, I think it was, I started podcasting kind of seriously, which is reasonably early. It's not that early compared to, you know, some of the founders of podcasting, but I laugh these days when some people come up, I hear people saying, oh, we've had a podcast for 10 years. We're one of the oldest podcasts around. And I'm like, God, I was doing this 15, 16 years ago, and I'm not one of the oldest podcasters around. So I don't know how you can say that. Yes. But yeah, so I got into that and I did, I got into social media stuff actually for the first time as that was starting to appear. And I met various people from around the world on various different sites and stuff. I used one. So the reason I got into podcasting, this is a good link to Twit actually, was because of Twit. I started listening to podcasts in 2005, maybe 2006. And one of the first ones that I really listened to was Twit. I heard Leo and... I heard him doing Twit, and then I kind of started discussing with friends who also listened to Twit. You know, doesn't seem that hard. Maybe we could have a go at that. And
it's funny, similar for me too. I actually early on for Linux Journal, we wanted to do podcasting, and I called into one of Leo's shows for microphone advice.
Oh, cool. Wow!
Yeah, I actually got what that's when it was like actually on TV even. But anyway, I see you have a decent. I like your microphone choice as well. I see
a mic
model. Yeah,
the Procaster. Yeah.
Oh no. Okay. I thought it was an RE20.
No, it's the Rode Procaster.
Oh, okay.
So I'm turning it away from me as I talk into it.
And Sean has the Electro Voice, whatever it is. That's really
I do the RE20, nice. Like
the extra cool
1960 or whatever.
Wow, they're nice microphones. So, yes. So we got very into that, but Linux Outlaws was what came out of it, was the podcast, and it became pretty popular. It was surprisingly, it was for a while. I mean, I don't really know how this happened, but within about 2 or 3 months of us starting in kind of early 2007, mid 2007, we were up to say 10,000, 20,000 listeners.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was. And it peaked at about 40,000 or 50,000 at one time.
Wow.
Downloads. Yeah. And we started to get mentioned in magazines and invited to things. And it was all kind of strange web celebrity. My friend calls it Webrity. It's like a short thing for web celebrity, Webrity. she said to me, you're now a Webrity. And I was like, oh, well, okay. If you say so.
Like it just means that at conferences, people like want your autograph, but nobody at the grocery store recognizes you. I think that's pretty much what that means. It's the best kind of famous.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's, you know, a real celebrity, you can't go out in public without being accosted, you know, and that kind of celebrity is a little more lightweight. It's nicely cloaked. I want to get a little bit into the music connection, but first I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures unsecured devices can't access your apps. Collide has some big news. If you're an Okta user, Collide can get your entire fleet to 100% compliance. Collide patches one of the major holes in zero trust architecture. That's device compliance. Think about it. Your identity provider only lets known devices log into apps. But just because a device is known doesn't mean it's in a secure state. In fact, plenty of devices in your fleet probably shouldn't be trusted. Maybe they're running on out-of-date OS versions, or maybe they've got unencrypted credentials lying around. If a device isn't compliant or isn't running the Collide agent, it can't access the organization's SaaS apps or other resources. The device user can't log into your company's cloud apps until they fix the problem on their end. It's that simple. For example, a device will be blocked if an employee doesn't have an up-to-date browser. Using end-user remediation helps drive your fleet to 100% compliance without overwhelming your IT team. Without Collide, IT teams have no way to solve these compliance issues or stop insecure devices from logging in. With Collide, you can set up and enforce compliance across your entire fleet, Mac, Windows, and Linux. Collide is unique in that it makes device compliance part of the authentication process. When a user logs in with Okta, Collide alerts them to compliance issues and prevents unsecured devices from logging in. It's security you can feel good about because Collide puts transparency and respect for users at the center of their product. To sum it up, Collide's method means fewer support tickets, less frustration, and most importantly, 100% fleet compliance. Visit collide.com/floss to learn more or book a demo. That's KOLIDE.com/floss. Okay, so Dan, you're for those of us watching this thing, you always have a bunch of musical instruments there. And I want to get the connection there because you kind of started on music. You talked about that. You were in bands and things, I assume. So make the connection there between that and your Linux work, because I suspect there's a lot.
Yeah, I suppose there is quite a link there. I mean, I'm sure you guys can probably attest to this as well, but I found in kind of going around various different open source worlds to conferences to various different things, it's amazing how many people you meet, are also like musicians or, you know, developers often have a musical link. And supposedly, I mean, I'm no expert on this, but supposedly there's a big link between mathematics and music. And I think maybe that links in with the whole kind of developer mindset of coding, and seeing, you know, music. Cause I suppose you can think of music actually as a kind of form of code anyway, because, you know, you've got a certain section, like a function might be a verse or a chorus, and you repeat it and you loop it and you, you know, you do these things that you would do in code, in music as well. So they definitely link. In terms of like open source and audio, I think a lot of it for me was, as I said, was like podcasting stuff. But I did get into doing stuff, open source music stuff as well. Sadly, not as much as, someone like Jonathan Bennett, who's in our parish, of course. I know he does a lot of stuff with Ardour, and so on. So I did a lot of studio work early on, before I got into kind of being more of a tech myself, more of a computer tech, I suppose. And we used to use a lot of things like proprietary tools like Pro Tools, and I used Cubase, one called Cubase, which is still going, which is a proprietary tool. But I did look into, when I got in more into Linux, I was like, I want to do audio on Linux. And as you'll know, there's a long history of people having problems with, not for a while, but when I kind of got into Linux in early kind of 2000, around 2000, early 2000s, there was a lot of people who had problems with audio interfaces and so on Linux, which was not necessarily a problem with the kernel or anything else. It was more a lot of the manufacturers didn't want to, for some reason, didn't want to play ball. But a lot of that stuff's really developed now. And I got into using... there's a German company called RME who make audio interfaces. And I learned that they actually do a thing where they give the latest interfaces that they make, they send complimentary units to kernel developers, not just kernel developers, really audio driver developers, and Linux audio people around the world, so they can get the support into the kernel and do stuff like that really early on and make sure it's really solid. So I bought myself an RME Hammerfall card, which, to be honest, was complete overkill because it was like 64 channels or something it could do. And it had like fiber optics on it and stuff. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. I could record like a whole orchestra and everyone could have like a separate channel and all this kind of stuff. And then it's like me and a guitar and a vocal. And I'm using like three channels. So I really kind of went over the top there. But it was nice to know that if the Philharmonic Orchestra ever turned up at my house, I could go, don't worry, folks, I've got like everything you need right here. Although actually,
that laugh was a little hard, wasn't it? That was kind of a mean laugh in the background.
Yeah. So it was interesting. So I got very into that, and I over the years I've kind of downsized the mixers and things that I use now. But I did at one time have a ridiculously overspecced home studio for stuff like that. But also technology's changed as well. I mean, you can do so much stuff with software now, which is amazing. Really, if you've got a laptop, a half, you know, fairly decent laptop, you've got everything you need for a studio. Get yourself a USB audio interface and all that kind of stuff. But one thing I found over the years is open source kind of stuff in relation to music and sound stuff has really come a long way. It's been really, really good. And I think things like the Raspberry Pi actually helped with that. I knew some people who got into using, like musicians who got into using the Raspberry Pi as a little audio interface and using the box to kind of stream stuff and all kinds, because there was all kinds of interesting projects came out of the pandemic and stuff around that as well.
So you play guitar and keyboards. I see that, right? What kind of gear are you using there? I mean, what is that guitar? Is that
hang on, I'll lean away from the mic slightly. If there's anyone in
the
this is an acoustic, yeah. If there's anyone in who's a guitar enthusiast, this is a Yamaha electroacoustic guitar, but it's actually a limited edition. I bought it in 1996, which is, you can't really see on the camera, but on the fret there, it actually says 1996. It was produced as a 10th anniversary of Yamaha guitars at the time, which was 1996. I believe it's this one of only like 1,000 maybe, or less than 1,000 in the world, this one. This is a normal acoustic. I've got a lot of different kind of Fender guitars. There's a Stratocaster over there.
And there's a red theme there. You've got the red in the headphones. You've got the red mic. You've got
red mic. Yeah. Yeah. Red's my favorite color. That's what that's about, I think.
That's cool. So you play in bands or a band or where? So when you go out and play right now, what are you doing?
At the minute, I haven't played out a lot lately, actually, to be honest, but it's more kind of solo stuff, like acoustic stuff, mostly singing, playing guitar. But I have been in a number of bands, actually. There's for many years I was in a band called 20 Pound Sounds. We used to play, we actually played quite a few kind of open sourcey events, which was interesting, because some of the events I was organizing, so it was like, well, I'm going to subject everyone to listening to my band, and we'd set up a stage on the Saturday night, and we'd have, you know, for like the party after the event or mid event, and we'd play stuff like that. So we had quite an interesting, quite a following through the podcasts and so on like that. That was a little 3-piece band. I haven't played with them for a while, sadly, but you never know. We might end up getting back together. But one of the strangest gigs I ever did was actually for a Red Hat conference. It was for a Red Hat Partner Summit, I think it was called. It was in Dublin, in Ireland, and I was invited over to play, which is interesting, at the Red Hat conference, which was quite a corporate event. So I don't really know why they wanted me to play guitar there, but there you go.
Maybe it was the red theme. That's what got you the gig, right?
It could have been. Yeah, it could have been. And maybe it was the red. I did take the red guitar, so maybe that was part of it. So, but I remember singing, Keep on Rocking in the Free World by Neil Young, which I thought was quite appropriate. And a number of people in red hats kind of jumping up and down singing, which was fun.
That's cool. There's it's funny. There's a when you said Neil Young, there's a great podcast, I've mentioned it before, called The History of Rock Music in 500 Songs by Andrew Hickey, and he's in Manchester, and he always talks about Neil Young and songs. S-U-N-G-S, or so it seems. Sean, do you play an instrument? I'm just curious if we get...
If I lean over away from my microphone, you can see I have a Stratocaster on the wall there. But nice. I don't play well. I play well enough. So my wife and I used to teach youth group at a church, and I play guitar well enough to get kids to play guitar well enough so that I don't have to play guitar. That's the extent of my ability. So I haven't played a whole lot, and I wanted to get better. I bought this guitar and I haven't played it, but maybe once, but anyway, yeah, it's a sad story with me and audio, but also every member of my family is so incredibly musically talented that it's a little overwhelming to do anything musical in their presence. I mean, every one of my daughters like leads music on stage for like multiple churches, you know. Yeah, they're amazing. They play like every instrument, even if they don't play. I mean, like, do you have a guitar? Oh, my guitar had a broken string. And they're like, oh, I'll just play the keyboard. Like, do you play keyboard? No, but I'll figure it out. And they do. I don't understand music, people. That is not me.
But you do satisfy the thesis that that people who code and people who are technical and people who are good at math, that they have to do all those things, tend to be musicians as well. And I mean,
I appreciate
it. I'm thinking about it. I mean, so many technical people I know play musical instruments.
And you know, we talk about music and math. I think music and math are so closely related, but you know, the artistry is in the errors, if you will. So I don't know, maybe the artistry is just bugs in the code. I don't, that's a metaphor that got stretched too far, but I don't know. I think especially the people that we tend to talk to are sort of creator heavy. Like they like to create things, whether it's code or music or content or whatever, podcasts. And yeah, we're all a little crunchy in that regard. So I'm curious, can you talk about your shirt? What is this about?
Camp. Yeah. Very, very quickly, I'll slip in a plug. I meant to say, if you want to find, because I think John was putting links up, was putting a scrolling something on the screen there. If you want to find the band that I was in and listen to the music, it's all on Bandcamp. It's £20.net, 20lb.net. Redirects you straight to Bandcamp if anyone wants to listen. Sorry, I thought I'd work that in. You can never resist a plug. So Odd Camp, this is something else that came out of kind of all the things I was doing with the podcasts and various different things. So in 2008, I think it would have been 2008, I went to an event called Lug Radio Live, which was run by another podcast in the UK called Lug Radio, which a lot of people will remember if you were into podcasts, particularly into Linux podcasts at the time. That was one of the most popular ones in the world. John O'Bacon was one of the hosts and some of the others who's gone on. He later ended up on Floss Weekly, John O, and now he does all kinds of stuff. I think he works for SpaceX or someone like that now, but he's doing very well. So I went to their event and they were running at the time the biggest kind of community, Linux open source community event in the UK, an annual get together, 2-3 day kind of conferencey thing. And they announced that they were stopping. So we decided to take, not take it over, but they kind of made a joke that, like, you know, someone else should do it and something similar. And, you know, and people joked, oh, are you going to take it over? So that's what happened. We ended up in 2009, we ran the first event, the first Odd Camp, which was a 1-day event. It was a bar camp style event. So it was an unconference. People could come along, pitch talks. And we had some really, really great talks. We had all kinds of stuff going on, lots of techie stuff and lots of non-techie stuff. One of the most interesting talks or most popular talks that we had at the first event was by a lady who came along and she got everyone to draw a picture of a pig on a doodle of a pig, basically on a piece of paper with a felt pen or whatever. And then she analyzed them based on how they'd drawn the pig. Which was quite interesting. So, like, apparently there were little things like how curly you made the tail apparently was supposed to reflect how flamboyant you were, and how long the tail was something to do with, like, how confident you were and all these kinds of things. But that, it was a strange little talk, but it became very, very popular. It was something that you wouldn't expect. So, yeah, we ran that, and then it ran for 10 years. So the shirt I've got on now, which I can kind of lift the mic slightly out of the way, it says 10-year anniversary, people will be able to see. This was from the event we ran in 2019. which was the 10-year anniversary of OggCamp. And it became the most kind of the most popular, maybe that's not fair, one of the biggest anyway, open source Linux events in the UK, an annual thing. I ran it for 10 years, although I think I missed like one or two years, so maybe I ran 8 out of the 10 years. And then of course we had we were going to do it in 2020, but then that got stopped by the pandemic and the lockdowns and everything, so we couldn't run it then. But we had some awesome things over the years. We had great speakers and guests, and one year I managed to get Stephen Fry to do a talk, like a recorded talk, which is still my kind of crowning achievement, to be honest, because that was quite impressive. But I tried to get him to come along. This was in 2012. He did the thing for OggCamp in 2012, which was in Liverpool that year. We moved around a little bit, but a lot of them were in Liverpool. Some of them were in other places. I knew he was interested. I knew he was very into technology. I knew he was kind of an Apple guy. I think he was the second owner of an Apple computer in the UK, after Douglas Adams, who was author of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, who was his friend who got the first Apple computer in the UK in the 80s, when they came out. And I knew that Stephen Fry was very into computing. So I tried to get him to come along to OggCamp. I thought I'll just try and pitch him, but I didn't have any contact information. I didn't know where to start. I mean, how do you deal with that? Because I don't know how famous he is in the US, but over here, he's kind of pretty famous.
He's,
you know what I mean?
Pretty famous here.
He's pretty famous, for sure.
Yeah. So he's not the sort of guy you can just pick up the phone and get on the phone very easily. So what I did was, he had a website. At the time, his website was stephenfry.com. And I just, you know, as a kind of Hail Mary, kind of like, I'm just going to try this, see what happens. I typed up an email and I sent it to stephen@stephenfry.com. Didn't even know if the address existed. And I thought no more about it, really. And then 2-3 weeks later, I got a reply from Stephen Fry himself. And I was like, is this is someone having a joke with me, winding me up here? Is this really him? And it was him. And we actually wrote back and forth a few times, exchanged like 5-6 emails, to the point where I started to feel a bit embarrassed because I felt like I was bothering him too much. I said to him, like, is there an agent or someone that I should speak to? Because I feel like I'm, you know, I don't want to take up too much of your time or cause any problems. And he's just really lovely. And he was like, oh, no, don't worry about it. It's fine. So he did. You can find it on YouTube. I'll post some links.
It's interesting to me. We had a glitch here, but that's okay. Most of you would hear it or see it. But I just want Dan to know that your audio seemed to work fine while your face was frozen.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's like, I think it's, you know, the system's sort of biased to audio for that reason. The last time I was in your part of the world wasn't that close. It was actually Birmingham.
Not too far.
For GWADEC, which is the GNOME conference. And which is a lot of fun. Geek conferences are great. And I'm wondering, this is OggCamp. So this is Og as in Og Vorbis, right? Is that correct?
Yeah. So the name was something that I came up with. And to be honest, I think originally I was the only one who kind of liked it. And then maybe people grew to like it over time. It's a strange name. People who don't know anything about like what Og is, for a start, they're like, what the hell is that? And they think it's like Odd Camp with two D's, which it probably more appropriate. But it's Og basically because I wanted something that, because it was free culture and free software kind of was the idea. So I wanted something that kind of in some way mixed the idea of, you know, free software, open source, all of that, with the idea of music, media, you know, art creation. And I was like, well, Og's a free format. So
yeah, the people at Vorbis camp were really angry. They were.
Well, do you know, the strange thing is you're in good company there, Sean, because when I wrote to Stephen Fry and said, will you come to Og camp and try to explain what it was, he wrote back saying, what is this Vorbis con thing that you're talking about? Because, and I was like, wow, okay. Because he made a joke about it being Vorbis con. So there you go. So that's where it came from. That's where the name came from. But it kind of took on a life of its own. People keep asking if it's going to happen again. I hope so. we'll see. Since we cancelled, unfortunately, I had to cancel because of COVID in 2020. I haven't been as involved really. So I've kind of figured like I did 10 years and I was like, somebody needs to take this over because I've done 10 years and then someone can come in. And we had some great volunteers who came in, and who knows, watch this space. It might happen again. You never know. The website's all still there, ogcamp.org. And as I was saying, I think before I got cut off, if you search for Stephen Fry Ogcamp or Ogcamp Stephen Fry, you'll find the video that he did. And it's really interesting. It's 15, 16 minutes long. And he just sent it to me via like iCloud or something. I got an email one day saying, Stephen Fry has shared something with you on iCloud. I thought, wow, that can't be real. So then I clicked on it. And sure enough, it was a video that he'd made for us where he answered questions that we'd sent him, a list of questions. Some technical questions where he talked about, we asked him about computing and some other silly questions like, if you were a dinosaur, what dinosaur would you be? And I won't spoil his answer, so you can go on and watch that if you like.
Oh, now I have to.
I saw him once perform live in a one-man show about Oscar Wilde. It was really good. It was really, really good show. He's a very funny guy and taller than I expected. He's a tall guy.
He's very tall.
So we brought up Ogg Vorbis, I want to talk codecs for a second. I mean, is Ogg used that much at this point? I mean, I don't know. I cared about codecs like 25 years ago and haven't looked that closely since. And Ogg looked like it had some real chances of going, and they were working on a video codec too. What's happening around that now? Are you paying much attention?
Before you answer, can I give you my layman's thoughts?
Oh, please do.
How correct I am? And then I'll let the professional kind of answer there. So it seems like everything's either AAC, MP3, or FLAC if you don't want to have it, if you want it to be like perfect. Is that the case? Or yeah, what's the professional answer to that?
Well, pretty much. I think, does anyone still use Ogg is a good question. I don't know. Actually, I don't use it a lot these days. I did at one time. I used Ogg Vorbis a lot as an alternative to MP3 because there was some, well, as you guys will know, there was some worries about what would happen when the patent licenses ran out.
Yes, Fraunhofer, whoever owned MP3,
Fraunhofer Institute, made threats,
yeah, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, they kind of threatened people over what would happen with if they'd used MP3s. You know, could they be sued for that? It hasn't happened. And I think MP3s become the kind of de facto low quality, but lowish kind of quality, you know, good for bandwidth and size and all the rest of it, kind of audio codec. But FLAC's great. I love FLAC. FLAC is completely free as well. It's free as in beer and free as in freedom as well. That's a great format. It's really high quality. I tend to use when I'm doing audio work, to be honest, because I do produce some podcasts for other people. And I tend to use WAVE. We just use like full WAVE files.
It's funny too, because now that bandwidth and storage is so cheap,
yeah,
you can use, you know, I mean, it used to be a concern like, oh no, what if my audio file is, you know, so big? Well, it doesn't really matter because, yeah, the biggest audio file is nothing. So.
Yeah, these days it doesn't matter so much. We used to get when we did Linux Outlaws and certain other podcasts that I've done, we did different feeds. So we would do an MP3 feed and we would do an Ogg feed,
right?
And things like that. And we used to get a lot of stick off people. A lot of kind of people would get very upset if we didn't put the Ogg feed up because they'd be like, "We want the Ogg feed." And you know, I don't know what it's like these days, but I'm talking like 10 years ago, 15 years ago. A lot of people were very much into like they wanted the Ogg version because it was, you know, it was unencumbered by patents and all the rest of it, and they wanted to support it. So yeah, it's good. As far as codecs go, I know what you mean, Doc. I don't think so much about codecs these days as I did at one time, because we all had to think, oh, you know, you'd get a video or whatever it might be, audio, and you'd think, is my computer going to play this? How am I going to get it to play it? But to be honest, since like VLC became a big thing, I've yet to find. I'm sure there are many things, but I've yet to find anything that VLC can't play for me, pretty much.
Yeah.
So since, and of course, VLC open source as well, so it links in.
I'm not even sure. I remember because I was someone involved in internet radio early on. We covered it a lot for Linux Journal, and this is before there were the big streaming services. There was no Apple Music or Napster had just been killed, but it's still nothing really replaced it yet. Spotify wasn't around, and So if you listen to internet radio, you're listening to a real radio station, or somebody who just come up with one, like, say, Radio Paradise, which is a fairly popular one. And you'd go there, like, on their website. So here's the 120 kilobit stream, AAC screen, stream, and here's the 64 kilobit MP3 stream. And so one of the radio stations I was talking to, like, they to hold down their own bandwidth costs, they said, well, we're doing talk, we're doing it at 32 kilobits. And you're right, I haven't thought about that. I don't think they've thought about it, or they're sure they do think about it, but it's not what it was. And I'm not even sure if you're listening, say, to Amazon Music or Apple Music or Spotify, I don't know what they're using. Do you know what they're using? Your app knows, I guess.
Probably AAC.
Probably AAC.
A lot of them.
Yeah.
Probably. Probably. I would think so, yeah. I mean, it's not as much of a concern these days. I'm interested, actually, Doc. I'm kind of asking you questions now because I can't help it.
Go for it. It's a circle here.
It's a useful thing. You mentioned internet radio. Did you do stuff with Icecast? Was that what you were using? Stuff like that?
No, mostly it was just covering it for other people. I mean, you were talking about you started podcasting in like 07 or 08. Mm-hmm. I started and stopped in 05. I got the setup. I did a couple of them with my kid, but I kind of wish I'd stayed at it, but yeah, I had other things to do.
You know, I mean, back then though, the bandwidth was just such a limiting
it
factor.
It was a huge issue.
Real audio came out and they were
like,
I made
a point of recording it like at some low bit rate, you know, and doing it in mono instead of stereo. That's another, like, one of those considerations. At the time,
and like trying to recompile, you know, re-encode them in real time, that was tough on CPUs back then.
Well, let me ask both you guys, because this is an interest of mine, and it plays in. Do either of you still listen to radio on a radio?
When I drive.
No. When you drive.
When I drive.
Yeah.
And that recently changed because my soon-to-be son-in-law is a car dealer and he reactivated our Sirius XM for like the free trial.
Yeah,
so
I've
been listening to Sirius XM. But that's pretty much the only time I listen to radio is when we're driving.
And because we've got like 4G everywhere now, I tend to just use, you know, an internet. I'm listening to radio stations, but I'm listening to them through, you know, some kind of internet stream, usually on a phone or in the car, maybe. Because I listen to radio all the time. I love it. And we have the BBC over here. I listen to a lot of BBC stuff. But they have an app for all of that now. They just have a radio app that you just. You
know, right. There's an outstanding app I highly recommend called radio.garden. And it's done by some guy, I think, in the Netherlands. And it's a globe. And you can zoom in on any particular point on the globe. And it lists all the live radio and web stations that are there. And you can kind of zoom in and listen to different stuff. It's a lot of fun. I mean, because what I'm watching happen almost in real time is over-the-air radio die. It doesn't mean that radio itself dies. It just moves to another medium. It just moves to... It moves to cellular.
It's kind of like when it went from AM to FM, right? I mean, the concept was still the same. And it kind of feels like another jump, like from that to digital, you know, because digital is easier to get everywhere.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing is like an AM radio, like a long wave in the UK, like the BBC long wave on 198 kilohertz is going to end like the end of next year. They're going to be done with it. And the weird thing about that is it covers not only the UK, it covers like part of France, Ireland. One signal covers all of that. And it's a cell about 800 miles wide. And there's one in France on 162 and in Germany on 153, I think. And they covered like most of Europe, both of them did. But long wave went out of fashion and it doesn't. The problem with AM and FM is that the frequencies are down close to sparks, and so electric cars play havoc with it. That's another thing. And this is way off your territory. I was just wondering. I'm just curious.
No, that's very, very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
We've got some back channel chat going on here.
I see
John
this.
Was asking about Audacity. So one of the things I kind of should have mentioned, actually, was when I got into doing podcast production for other people, which one of the podcasts that I've produced over the years was for the Software Freedom Law Center at the time. And then the Software Freedom Conservancy, as it is now, my friends Bradley and Karen, who work there, and they insisted that, Bradley's a very staunch free software guy. He was an FSF.
Yeah, Bradley Kuhn.
And he was. And he's been a guest, actually. I think he's been a guest.
I've been trying to get him back as a guest, but he wants us to have like the completely free chain in all
parts.
Yeah,
he won't use. Yeah,
so there are little bits in here that are less orthodox, unfortunately, but that was an issue for him.
But talk to him, get him on.
You know, like we'll figure something out. We'll rig something up.
I think we had him on a phone call last time. I think he was on like an old school phone. He does a lot of stuff with VoIP. He does do like asterisk. I always get that wrong. He does like asterisk VoIP stuff. He has a server for that. So I'm sure there's something we can do. But one of these kind of stipulations he kind of gave me when I started producing their show, when it first started, was he wanted me to use 100% open source free software tools and all that kind of stuff to produce it. So one of the things which I did anyway, to be honest, which was good. But one of the big things I used in my workflow, and I still do right now, is Audacity, which is what John was asking about there in the IRC, which is 100% open source free software. I find it a great tool. As Jonathan was saying, it's not quite as complete as something like Ardour. Ardour's like a proper music production digital audio workstation.
We've had Ardour on the show in the past.
Yeah, whereas Audacity is more kind of for small kind of editing things, I think. Anyway, that's just my opinion. But I use it all the time. Yeah. So that was one of the things that I still do it now. I try and keep as much of the stuff on open source kind of free software tools as I can. And most of it is. I mean, I can do it 100% that way, which as we talked about with Bradley was a big thing, and some other people who are into that, which goes back to the OGG thing as well. You know, they would want to use formats like OGG and stuff or FLAC or whatever.
Yeah, I've used Audacity exclusively is what I use to do audio editing rather. And because I have a complete inability to stop saying, but I know what my ums look like, I don't even need to listen. I just go through and I say, there's an um there. There's another um. I know the whole shape of it, the envelope. It's like, and I wish I gave my brain to do that so there are no ums. It's anyway. So is there any, I was thinking of terms we've left unstoned. I want to get back to some topics on the show, but first I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Bitwarden. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, at work, or on the go, and is trusted by millions, even by our very own Steve Gibson. He switched over. With Bitwarden, all of the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted, and not just your passwords. Protect your data and privacy with Bitwarden by adding security to your passwords with strong, randomly generated passwords for each account. Go further with the username generator. Create unique usernames for each account, or even use any of the 5 integrated email alias services. Bitwarden is open source with all the code available on GitHub for anyone to view. This means you don't have to trust their word. You can see that it's completely secure. On top of being public to the world, Bitwarden also has professional third-party audits performed every year, and the results are also published on their website. This is open source security that you can trust. Bitwarden also launched a new Bitwarden Secrets Manager, currently in beta. It's an end-to-end encrypted solution that allows teams of developers to centrally secure, manage, and deploy sensitive secrets like API keys and machine credentials. Secrets Manager keeps those sensitive developer secrets out of source code and eliminates the risk of them being exposed to the public. Bitwarden needs developers to help test out the new Secrets Manager and provide feedback. So learn more about that at bitwarden.com/secretsbeta. That's secrets beta, like it sounds. Share private data securely with coworkers across departments or the entire company with fully customizable and adaptive plans. Bitwarden's Teams organization option is $3 a month per user, while their enterprise organization plan is $5 a month per user. Individuals can also use the basic free account for an unlimited number of passwords, upgraded any time to a premium account for less than $1 a month, or bring the whole family with their family organization option to give up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 a month. At Twit, we are fans of password managers, and Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, on the go, or at work, and is trusted by millions of individuals, teams, and organizations worldwide. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. So guys, where were we? I erased my plan when I went to the ad there.
You guys were all going to send me gifts, and I was going to give you my address, I think.
I think you said gifts, then. I can send you some gifts if you want, some animated gifts.
I prefer GIFs.
GIFs, yeah. That's true. That's an argument. Is it GIF or GIF? I think it's supposed to be GIF, isn't it?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Yeah, the guy who invented it says GIF, so that's...
There was an interesting controversy with that where...
Oh, it's still... Yeah, the IRC channel is going to get nasty if we...
Oh, good. Tell us about it. It was owned by CompuServe or somebody, and it went to, I don't know, to H&R Block, and they sold it to somebody or something. There's some big company owned it, and then Don Marty, a friend of the show who's been on the show, former editor-in-chief of Linux Journal before I was, organized something called Burn All GIFs. And marched on the company that didn't even know they owned it to make something happen. Do you know what happened with that? I have no idea.
I don't. And I am not passionate either way. So I get enough hate mail for other reasons. I don't need to pick a side.
Yeah, that's true. We could get into the whole Linux versus Linux thing.
Yeah,
that was a thing for a while.
And Linux. But let's bring it back to Linux. You run the Linux... The Liverpool Linux Users Group, a lot of L's in there. How is the lug business going, to the degree it's a business at all? I mean, it's...
Do you call it the lug? Because that's...
We call it lug, yeah, yeah. So,
liver lug?
We call it the lug, yeah. Linux User Group. So I don't know. That was something I was going to ask you guys about, actually. So in the UK, I got involved with lugs or Linux User Groups in kind of... mid-2000s, maybe 2006, 2007, so quite late, actually. But I found that where I was, there were actually two different lugs. There was one in Liverpool, and there was one in Chester, which is kind of 40 minutes away, roughly, so it's not far. So I actually went to both. And now, today, I actually organized the Liverpool lug, and I have done for quite a long time. But I found that really useful at the time, because you could meet other people, talk about open sourcey, Linuxy things, and get kind of support. But I don't know if these days there are still as many around. So there used to be a thing called lug.org.uk, which was like and it still exists. It was like an umbrella kind of organization where, they would register, various different lugs. Liverpool lug is one of the ones that's registered. Mm-hmm. They would provide things like support, like a bit of web space for you to host, something, mailing lists, stuff like that. And the admins would help to run stuff. And that was all kind of charity funded, like public funded. And it's still going. But sadly, I hear a lot, and we have at Liverpool Lug, which I should mention, is livlug, livlug.org.uk is the website. We meet every month still on a Wednesday. We have a meeting first Wednesday of every month. And of course, lots of people have made the joke because it's called Livlug. We have the whole Live, Lug and Prosper thing going on. Of course. So that's in there as well. We talk about a lot of kind of science fiction stuff as well and other things, but we do meet every month and we have a mailing list and we have online community stuff as well. But it feels as though a lot of that kind of stuff's gone. So I'd be interested to hear kind of your guys' experience, because I don't know what it's like in the US with like lugs and so on. Are there still local lugs to you? Are they relevant? All that kind of stuff.
So I can just say, for me, I have always lived in a very rural area. There's never been a lug anywhere remotely close to where I live. I could have started one, but me and the one other person who I convinced to listen to me doesn't make a great user group. So I've never actually been a part of a lug. I've spoken at a couple, And I know there are still some that are active. Like there's a, and they actually don't call themselves a LUG. They just call themselves a Michigan Users Group, mug.org. And I think it's Linux/Unix. I think that's where they're not specifying for Linux, but they're still active and still going, and but it's virtual right now. The last couple times over the past couple of years, when I've spoken, it's been virtual. I think that and I don't know if the crowd in the past has been a younger crowd. It seems to be an older crowd now, people who enjoyed it, 10, 15 years ago and, still get joy out of hearing the presentations and the camaraderie and stuff. But it doesn't feel like, it feels like it's sort of aging itself out of existence. And I don't know, but I don't have a great idea because, like I said, I'm not part of a local one myself.
There was one in Santa Barbara. It was pretty active and I spoke at it once or twice, but I don't think it's there anymore. And I wonder whether, we were going to focus a lot on community building here. I think that what's happened is that we were talking to Greg Crow Hartman a couple of weeks ago, the great, maintainer. And, there's the sense that I get from him, and there was a particular point I was trying to think of, but it was basically the Linux one. I mean, Linux is in everything. As an embedded operating system, it rules the world, and most people don't know it's there in your brake system or whatever else it is. But I think there's always going to be the hackable end of it, and that doesn't go away. And so I'm wondering, and this is maybe a last question for you, Dan, before, because we're getting low on time here. What the people who are participating now, how does that differ from and the way it was 10 or 15 or 20 years ago? And what encourages you, or what would make you want to get more people into it? Or what I'm getting a sense, I want a sense of what, How do we evangelize this thing? There's probably five questions there, but sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. I think it's changed a lot. And actually, the point that you made there was one I was gonna make as well. That in some ways, I think like LUGs specifically and those kind of things, user groups have become less relevant because they're less needed because Linux has become so mainstream. It used to feel like a little outlaw club that people didn't, we were like the people that nobody understood and we were outside of the mainstream. And now everybody's got a phone that runs Android or, they've got a TV that runs Linux or any of these things. And they've become less relevant. So I think in some ways that's a victory and it's great and it's good. But what I found certainly over here anyway in the UK is things have really started to change in, you mentioned hacking. It's now become more like a maker kind of culture. Or makerspace kind of culture. We're also fortunate to have a really great makerspace in Liverpool called Does Liverpool. And that's where we have our Linux user group meetings, but they have other groups there as well. And what a lot of people are more interested in now is not like, how do I make the audio work on my laptop or whatever? They want to go, how do I link this, LED to this sensor to do this, to do that? And a lot of it's come from the Raspberry Pi, I think. That kind of gave Linux a really big boost, I think, because initially, I mean, you can run Windows, I believe, on the Pi now, but initially you didn't really, and so on, and Arduinos and all those kind of things. They're all open source. They're all Linux-y kind of things. So that's where it's gone, I think, in the UK, is a lot of the maker kind of stuff and the that kind of culture. And unfortunately, it's just where it's gone.
Physical activity, right? I mean, you have to be physically there to do a lot of the maker stuff. It's, you're literally making things. And and I think that a lot of what used to be part of a Linux user group has moved online. Like, for example, my little community of people around my YouTube channel and my stuff, they're all over the world. We have similar, interests and stuff, but we don't have to physically be there because it's not like we're soldering over each other's shoulders, right? It's that physical stuff though, the maker world. I think that's a really keen observation there, that the maker world is certainly makes more sense to meet in meet space.
Yeah, I think it definitely works a lot that way. We have as I said, because we have a makerspace nearby, a hackerspace, whatever you want to call it, which we're really lucky to have that. And they've got a brilliant workshop. You can go and use the workshop. They've got 3D printers and laser cutters and loads of exciting things that, yeah, you definitely need to be there physically to do the. You could maybe send your design to be cut or printed or whatever, but you need to be there to kind of put the piece of wood in the machine and the plastic and all the rest of it. And get it out and all those kind of stuff. And I think there's a lot to be learned from that as well. It seems as though that's really growing still, actually. So one thing I should mention, actually, on the whole maker thing, before we run out of time, is that one of the things I got involved with over the years is a thing called Liverpool Make Fest, which I've talked about on here before, which is a one-day event, a bit like a maker fair. You might know a maker fair kind of thing. They've been around for ages. This is what we call a make fest, which is slightly different, partly due to branding issues, but we won't get into that. So this is a make fest, not a maker fair. And it's a 1 day event. It's coming up. There's a Liverpool Make Fest. It's a whole day. It's free. It's on from, I think, 9 a.m. till 5. It's at Liverpool Central Library. It's on the 1st of July, Saturday, the 1st of July. So it's like a week on Saturday coming up. If you're in the UK and you live within a reasonable traveling distance of Liverpool or wherever you're from, if you want to come, you're welcome. Come along, get involved. There's all kinds
what
of
happens?
Stuff.
Going. Yeah. What actually happens?
So we take over the library for the whole day. We got 4 floors of the library. We have lots of people doing things like there's a soldering workshop. If you're interested in learning how to do solder and stuff, which, to be honest, I haven't done much soldering in a long time. I could probably.
I think it requires 3 hands, and I only have 2, so I can never solder properly.
And this is what in the US we call soldering, even though it's spelled soldering.
Oh, is it soldering? Oh, yeah. Is it right?
It's
I never knew that.
It's fine. It's like schedule and schedule. It's cool.
true. You say potato, I say potato. soldering or soldering, if you call it that. We've got workshops for that. You can come along and we've got the Liverpool Astronomical Society. They're going to be on the roof. They're going to be, there's a roof terrace. They're going to have telescopes set up there. They're going to tell you all about things in the, in space and the solar system and things you can see with your own telescope. If you want to do that, you can learn all about that. You can do things like, there's even things like a Nerf gun firing range where you can, it's an interactive game that some friends of ours made, which is all, again, open source. It's great. I think it actually uses Raspberry Pis to do the embedded stuff, but they have these little boxes that it's called Made Invaders. It's a bit like Space Invaders, and they have little Space Invader style, LED displays on these boxes, and when you hit them with the Nerf gun, you get a point, and it all adds it up and puts in on a nice old school kind of display at the above. Yeah, so that gets the kids excited, and then it's kind of getting them in with things like that, and then you can say, oh, would you like to make your own game, or how would you want to do this, and they usually get excited about it because they want to do stuff like that. And we've got all kinds of stuff going on there. As I say, it's at liverpoolmakefest.org is the website. If you want to have a look at it, you can find out more on there. There's a list of all the makers, there's videos of previous events. I'm helping out. I'm one of the organizers, but it's on all day, and it's something that we're trying to push kind of nationally. And a lot of the people who are involved are educators. So the founders, the people who set it up, one of them is a university lecturer. The other one is a teacher who's been a guest on the show, my friend Caroline. She was Teacher of the Year in the UK a few years ago, which was quite impressive. And she, the first school makerspace in the UK, school hackerspace in the UK, in her school 6 years ago or something now. And that's been expanded as well. And they're trying to do so what they call STEM, which is, I think, what is it? Science, technology, engineering, and maths, I think.
STEM,
I may have got that right. So
I think you have that right, yeah.
Yeah, so they push in what they call STEM education for kids and for adults as well. And one of the great ways of doing that is getting them to do things like strangely shoot things with a Nerf gun and then go, how does that work? And then they want to know, how does the machine know that when I've hit it and all this? And you can say, oh, there's a sensor here, and then it does this and it does that. And you can get them to make, so they're doing things like, there's a thing called Pi Wars as well, which is a bit like Robot Wars, where people can make, robots with wheels on and things and race them and crash them into each other. Although I think if I spent too long making a robot and then someone crushed it, I'd probably cry. I don't know if I'm up for that, but yeah, you can. They have a thing called Pi Wars, which is like Robot Wars, where they actually fight each other, the robots. Yeah, and there's all kinds of crazy stuff like that going on. Yeah, so it's great. It's all day. It's free. So I think that's kind of where things are going a bit in, so at least in the UK. I don't know how it is for you guys in the US, but certainly over here where we are, it's becoming more of a kind of a hands-on makery culture. Obviously the software is still there underneath, and you know, it's become less of a issue though. You just know that you can get something on, you know, that will run on your Raspberry Pi or ESP32 or whatever embedded computer you've got, and just you're away.
Well, this is great. We have actually gone, because we started early, that's never happened for me, but we can do it here. We've gone over 9 minutes longer than we normally do. So I'm going to quick just ask you, because we've always asked other people, what are your favorite text editor and scripting language?
Damn. Yeah, I never get to answer this. I'll give you a quick answer, seeing as we are over. A favorite programming language or scripting language, I should say, would probably be Python. Although Bash is really useful. Never underestimate what you can do with a Bash script. I would say so. Python and Bash. A text editor, I would say Vim. Apologies to the Emacs people. But yeah, for me, it's got to be Vim. Or actually these days, if I'm doing any serious kind of coding and I need like an IDE, I'll use Visual Studio Code, which is open source, and very a really cool. Great tool. And it's brilliant to see that Microsoft have come that far down the road now that, you know, they're producing open source development.
Yeah, like Microsoft's that. On our road. It's kind of weird. It's like a big truck on our road. It's like we haven't seen that. What's that doing here? This has been great, Dan. Thanks so much for doing this. This is a fun show, and we have a lot of show notes. And thank you too, Sean. We're gonna have to have you on and ask you questions.
Yeah, we can swap my hair.
It's like, where did you grew out your green hair? Did it wear off, or did it just get cut off at a certain point?
I had to cut it off. My daughter's getting married, and when I walk her down the aisle, the focus has to be on her, not on the weird guy with the green hair. That's the reason it's not green. Yeah.
Are you going green again after the wedding?
I don't know. I kind of liked it, so maybe.
I kind of liked it too as a look.
Do it.
Yeah. You and Marcus Smart for the Boston Celtics, he dyed his hair green. And I suppose if it gets traded, he'll dye it some other color. There's trading rumors lately for Celtics fans. Anyway, thank you so much, everybody. I have to look and see who we have next week. Oh, boy. I've done this. I have to go look at the schedule and see what it is. And
Stephen Fry next week, isn't it? That's
if he's still got the same email address, I'll try it.
All right. You threw me off on that, and so I it's
actually,
okay.
To be honest, he's really technical guy, actually. Very impressive. He knows, he's done a lot of programming, so I'll try.
So the topic is crossplane. and Jonathan is the co-host, and Aaron, who's another one of our co-hosts, is involved with that. So Jonathan's going to be doing the interviewing, and we're not sure who we're getting from crossplane, but crossplane is interesting, and that is coming up next week. And the week after that, by the way, is Golda Velez, and Catherine is going to be co-hosting on that one. I'm getting a jump on that, so I'll remember. I'm going to see her in a few hours. I'm driving from here in Petaluma up to D Web Camp, which is going to be fun for the distributed web.
Oh, is Catherine there?
Catherine's not there, but Golda is there. And No, Catherine's not there. Catherine's still in Houston. And we remain scattered from California to Liverpool this time. So thanks again, Dan. Thanks again, Sean. This has been a great show.
Thanks, Dan. It's great talking to you. We've never been on a show together because
I know we'll have to get the whole band together for some fun and have Dan on the keyboards and guitar at the same time.
Jonathan's musical. Get him in as well.
I'm guessing he is without knowing anything.
I think my family come in and they can sing and play.
I think Aaron plays the piano. Doesn't Aaron play the piano as well? We've got a whole
band. It could be. That would make sense. I'm a wannabe drummer. If you need somebody to play the rub board or the tambourine or the bongos or the congas, I'm that. I'm good.
I'll run the mixer.
I was envisioning Animal from the Muppets for you there, Doc.
Oh, yeah. I could do that.
He's a drummer.
Yes, he is.
I forgot about that. That's right. Anyway, this has been great. This has been Floss Weekly. We'll see you next week.
It's midweek, and you really want to know even more about the world of technology. So you should check out Tech News Weekly, the show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news.
It's the biggest news. We talk with the people writing the stories that you're probably reading. We also talk between ourselves about the stories that are getting us even more excited about tech news this week.
So if you're excited, well, then join us. Head to twit.tv/TNW to subscribe.